Answorth Reel 7. When you got to Birmingham, were the civilians much in evidence?
Very much. The platform was crowded with people, and we were up at the in the corridors by then, you see, and there was this one of these chaps, Bill Mead, he had a German helmet. I had one, but because not being able to get back to my battery, I'd lost mine and all, everything, you see. But he was showing this, and they started to bid him for it. And eventually the bids got up to £4.10, which is an awful lot of money in 1916. And then the train suddenly began to move and we were off. And I remember several times afterwards, when we were in hospital, Bill used to say, we were broke. I wish I'd sold that bloody helmet when I had the chance.
Tell me, why was there such a big crowd at Birmingham, do you think?
They knew the train was coming. Mm-hmm. Knew the train was coming. Oh, yes, they must have done. And now, we got off from there. And we arrived at Manchester.
But at Birmingham, you were saying that there was some excitement amongst the people who were waiting.
Well, everybody was congratulating us, you know, and giving us gifts and such as that, you know. And but there was no warning. The train suddenly moved off.
What were they congratulating you about?
What were you supposed to have won on the Somme?
Can you remember the kind of impression they created?
Well, they seemed
or the
to
kind
think,
of things they said?
They seemed to think that because we'd made an advance, we're well on the way towards winning the war. But to our mind, I thought we were rather optimistic, to say the least.
Did you disillusion any of them?
No, not really. I don't remember all that was said at the time, but yeah. I remember when we arrived at Manchester.
Well, why do you think that they thought the Somme operation was such a success?
Well, I should say that the newspapers had cracked it up as being an advance, and therefore they thought it was a success. They didn't think about the cost of it, a lot of them. Mm. You don't know what was in these people's mind. I mean, we were in France at the time when they got the news, so we just don't know what they thought. Mm.
But were there any particular kinds of indicators that they thought the Somme was a success? I mean, they have sort of banners welcoming you home and things like that?
Oh, some of the children had flags and that sort of thing, you know. But mostly it was just, I think, the novelty of it. There was a huge batch of wounded coming through, you see, because the hospitals in France just couldn't cope with them, and men who were only lightly wounded were being shoved over to England. When you remember that we had 60,000 casualties within 59,000 some hundreds, on the first day alone, that the hospitals in France were simply overwhelmed. They just couldn't, they didn't know where to put them. That's why we were dumped in these schools and things, they didn't know where to put the men. So, get rid. There were some fellows who got to hospital with me. They were only in hospital 3 or 4 weeks, and then they were discharged. Mm. Just slight wounds, you know.
So, after Birmingham, you moved on?
We got to Manchester then. When we came out of the station there, you never saw anything like it. The crowd was such that they had mounted police to hold them back. And some of the serious cases, they were loaded into ambulances. We were loaded into cars, civilian cars, all the walking cases. I was in a 1216 Sunbeam, a gentleman and his son in front, and it was myself. It was open car, you know, the open tour, as they called them in those days. And the rear part was all filled up with sacks of straw, something like that, and we were laid across there, absolutely out in the open. And as we drove through Manchester at a walking pace, the cars were just being mobbed. The chap who was with me, he was only very small. I learned afterwards he was a jockey, but he was 27 years old and he had two or three kids, and I thought he was a drummer boy or so, a little fellow like him. He was getting all the attention, but you could gauge the hysteria when I tell you that they were giving us such things as balaclava helmets in the middle of July, going into hospital. Cigarettes, sweets and things. Oh, enough to stock a shop, but balaclava helmets, I ask you. I mean, all the stupid things. But they felt that they'd got to give you something. That was what was behind it. And that crowd lasted all the way to Rochdale, 13 miles. The route was lined all the way to Rochdale. And when we got to Rochdale, there were more people there waiting to receive us than there were patients. And there were 690 men went into that hospital that day. And it only had accommodation for 200. It was a workhouse infirmary on Smitherbridge Road in hospital, in Rochdale.
During this trip to Rochdale, can you tell me any more about the crowd reactions?
Only that they were, every time you slowed down, they were chucking things in the car at you. Even if it was only packets of cigarettes. Mm. They wanted to give you something to show their appreciation, I presume. And when we got to Rochdale, we were unloaded into this place. And I was bathed by two men who I found out were weavers, in the cotton industry. And they were as gentle with me as a woman could have been. And I was way there, and I weighed only something over 9 stone. And I was 11 stone odd when I was hit. I'd lost 2.5 stone. Because, you see, when the jaw had been locked up, I had nothing to eat. I'd only had a few drinks. I hadn't had anything to eat at all. I'd lost blood and I'd lost weight as well. I had nothing to eat. That was in 6 days from being hit. It was July 23rd when we got to Rochdale.
And at Rochdale, you were in the Birchill Workhouse, which had been converted.
That's right.
Been converted to a hospital. Mm.
No, only the hospital itself. The workhouse still functioned normally.
Oh, I see.
It's just the workhouse hospital which was taken over. And to accommodate all the overflow, there were all these marquees outside. And how they managed that, they didn't know until Sunday morning that this trainload of wounded was coming. And the hospital master, Mr... No, I think of his name later. Haywood, H-E-Y, Haywood, or Hayworth. He sent out, with some of the old workhouse inmates, to all the places of worship in Rochdale, notices asking for helpers up at the infirmary that evening because they expected a batch of wounded. Damn it, all Rochdale had come, nearly. And the final straw was girls who were coming round with a big form, filling in your details, and the bottom was next of kin. Just in case, you see. And there was one girl who found out she was the daughter of the local postmaster at the bottom of the road, which the hospital was up to, you see. And for a long while after, we called her Miss Next of Kin before we knew her proper name. Mm.
Mm. Were the conditions in the hospital quite good?
Oh, yes. I had the time of my life there. I mean, it was a civilian hospital. And the military, it was under the Second Western General at Manchester. Colonel Westmacott was in charge there, and a Captain Wright, I think his name was, used to come once a month, and sometimes the Colonel came. That's all we saw of the control. Otherwise, the Dr. Coker was the resident doctor there, and there was a Dr. Wright and Dr. Scar and his son as well. He was only 26, and we had a dust-up with him, one of the Irishmen did. When we were convalescents, we used to go down to the town of an evening. We're not supposed to do it, so we were supposed to be in at four, but the nurses winked. They never said a word when you came in late. Just a naughty boy, something like that, get into bed. Mm. And so we used to come in through a back entrance. There was a tall iron rail fence, you see, and we'd sprained a couple of the bars so that they bent wide enough to get through. But if you turned them at an angle, from a distance, they didn't look to be bent at all. He used to turn these two bars, we could squeeze through. Well, evidently, Dr. Scar had got to know about this. And so one night, he was waiting for us. There was four of us coming back. And one of these chaps was an Irishman. He was in the Munster Fusiliers. Only remember us, Paddy, that's all. And Scar said something about, wording would have been all that, you see. And Paddy started on him, a big fine man like you, etc. You ought to be in the army, etc., etc. He's talking all the time. He never gave Scar to get a word in edgeways. And we were all the time sidling further on. We disappeared and we never heard any more about it.
On these expeditions into town, you must have come into a good deal of contact with the civilians. Did you get any particular impressions about the extent of their knowledge of what was going on in the war?
Not particularly. They were more inclined to be hospitable to you than anything else. For instance, we used to go on a Tuesday afternoon to a matinee at the Hippodrome. Free matinee at the Hippodrome in Rochdale. And there was two music halls, the Hippodrome and the Empire, and they combined the artists to give a matinee on the Tuesday afternoon with probably one or two local artists. There was Harry Wiley, I think his name was, Harry Wiley, a ventriloquist or a elocutionist, rather, not ventriloquist, elocutionist. He used to be there sometimes, local man. And as you're coming home, if you walked any distance, there'd be these women on the doorstep on this road. What the devil is the road now?
That doesn't matter.
No. They'd invite you, will you stop and drop in and have a cup of tea? My boss will been in a few minutes. That was the husband. They'll refer to him as their boss, you see. And in the schools, the children refer to the headmaster as the boss. inviting you in like that. If you went home on the tram, went back on the tram, you'd find that some of these factory girls had paid your fare. The conductor, we were travelling at half fare, you see, in any case. But these factory girls would give the conductor your fare. There was a Jew used to come up to the hospital. It's something to do with the Board of Governors. I've forgotten his name. And he used to be going back about maybe 2 o'clock when we were going uptown. And these were double-decker trams, bogey trams, you know, would carry about 60 or 70 people. He'd pay for every one of us on the car. Mm.
Did these civilians then show no curiosity to learn from you about the war?
Not that I remember. No. We used to get visitors up there at the hospital at times, you know, to see relatives, I know. But there was one, I remember, 2 or 3 weeks after I'd got in, because I was still all bandaged up, you know. And this lady came, and she's very solicitous. She must have mistaken me for somebody I don't know. She said, how is my wife and children? I was astounded. I was 21, 3 weeks after I got to the hospital. Five days after I got to the hospital. And so she was rather surprised. She thought I was over 30. But, you know, I think, looking back, that you aged more at that time. Shall I put it this way? You age several years in a few days.
I can understand that.
See? Whether it was in the lines of your face or what, I wouldn't know. But people, from that point onwards, people took me to be older than my years at the time.
Mm. Now, the hospital you were in here at Rochester, was that organised as a military hospital or was it a civilian hospital?
It was a civilian hospital controlled by the military from Manchester. But as I say, we only saw any military once a month. And they were so well treated there that in the early part of December, the resident doctor, Dr. Coker, was asking chaps who were ready to be discharged, did they want to stay another week or two over Christmas? And you'd be surprised how many of them stayed over Christmas there. Mm. And a number of them who'd been discharged the week before Christmas came back to the hospital for Christmas dinner during their leave. Mm.
Now, you yourself moved on from Rochester to...
I went on to Manchester.
Yes, which hospital was that you were in?
Ducie Avenue. It was a school. That was a school taken over by very, very military. Very, very, very military, yes.
How did it differ from the Rochester hospital?
It was appalling.
Tell me about it.
I arrived there. I went for specialist treatment on my jaw, you see. And I arrived there. And I went into, it's all lit by gas, not even incandescent, the old batswing burners. Bloody awful place it was. And there was 11 men in this ward, I remember, and I arrived just before tea, and they brought in 2 tins of sardines for tea, amongst 11 of us. So I objected to that, and they said, well, that's all we get, sister, well. I'll go and do something about it. So I went to find one of these sisters. Now, there were 3 of them, and no one could decide who was senior. They all thought they were, and they were all the time, the 3 of them, giving orders, and then the other one countermanding them, you see. And the VAD nurses didn't know where they stood. One of these, day too later, the girl who was in this ward, she was in tears over this business. But I went to this woman and told her that these weren't sufficient rations, you see. That was a ration, that's all we would get. So I said, oh, well, I'm going to the governor then, you see. She gave me 4 more tins of sardines. Somebody had been doing very nicely out of those rations, I reckon. But however, next day...
Tell me more about the organisation of the hospital, how it differed from the Rochdale Hospital.
Well, we were having treatment. I was having treatment there. They were squirting something out of a syringe in my jaw. What good did I don't know. I was x-rayed again there. Well, I was x-rayed at the hospital at Rochdale every fortnight. They had their own x-ray, you see. And this piece of shell, which was in... It was lodged in the bone in my jaw, and as the bone knitted together, it gradually forced it out, but on the inside, and it's still there, as a matter of fact, and they decided that the only way to remove it was by an operation from behind the bone, you see. And the sister on the hospital, she said to me, don't let them do it, Leonard. She says... They'd be very, very close to the jugular vein if they do that. And, she said, and if they cut the facial nerve, she said, your face will be pulled up on one side and nothing else they can do about it. She said, if it's safe where it is, she said, don't you let them do it. And so I wouldn't have it.
Hmm. You said the hospital was run on strict military lines.
At Ducie Avenue, yeah. Oh, yes.
What did that mean? I'm still interested in how it differed from Rochdale.
Well, in the first place, we had to be in at 4 o'clock.
In the afternoon?
Yes. I didn't know that. You had to hand in your greatcoat, and you had to sign for it when you went out. I didn't know that. I marched out the next day to have a look at Manchester with my coat on. Didn't come back until 5 o'clock. Bloody hell. Because I hadn't given my coat in because I was an hour late, etc., etc. I'm on a charge. I'm up before this doctor in the morning about something. And then the next day, this girl was in tears, and so I rounded on this one of these sisters, you know. I said, she's just been told by Sister so-and-so what to do with me, you see. I said, now you're telling her different. I said, what's she supposed to do about it, you know? I'm booked for that, for insubordination. So on the Saturday morning, I have three charges already in 4 days. And so I went up to this doctor on this charge again, you see. And he looked at me,